I mean, he's no Sanguinius, you know what I'm saying?
Charge the ion accelerator. It's time to forge the narrative.
Welcome everybody to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host, Bella Bell Souls Podcast. I'm joined by Tanya Gates.
Hi everybody.
Adam Camilleri.
Howdy.
And Red Powell.
What up?
Welcome again. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for listening. Sorry about last week. I was away for a good part of the week. I was doing commentary on Warhammer TV. Check us out over there if you haven't already.
Kind of big deal.
Yeah,
it was fun.
It looked fun.
Thanks for all the people that showed up and you just sounded off in chat. Let us know what they were working on, the hobby stuff. Really appreciate it. And also to the crew, you know, behind the scenes and to Nick there with me. Everybody had a great time at the tournament. It seems like, you know, over 300 and something people playing Warhammer, you know, between Age of Sigmar and Warhammer 40,000 in a great city.
Did I hear right? It was the biggest singles Age of Sigmar event in the world.
Recently.
Yeah, for the new edition.
I think so,
of the game. It's the biggest singles event that's happened to date with the new edition, which I think is amazing. And well done to G-Dub for spearheading. Essentially, that's them just taking the forefront and being like, well, we're going to run and take control of this scene to some extent. And I feel like that's really encouraging for a lot of reasons.
There are some gorgeous armies there, players from all different skill levels. What I could tell hobby-wise and probably play-wise. I know for a fact that there was, you know, more than just a handful of people there that were there for their very first tournament.
That's a great environment to get started at.
Yeah, I had the pleasure of talking about a game on stream that was someone's their first thing they ever painted. Their Warhammer army was the first thing they ever painted. Thought that was amazing.
Yeah. That's something we could talk about. What was everyone's first event? What was the first thing you went to? Because the people who rocked up for their first event at the G-Dub one, my first event ever was a games day when I was, I think, not even 13 years old. I got chucked in a bus and they took us to games day where it was just, I didn't play in any events there. I just walked around oogling all the dioramas and the special bits and pieces. And it was amazing. It was my first exposure to like a big Warhammer or hobby-centric event, and it was phenomenal.
I did a bunch of, of course, local things, but you mean like a grand tournament, like big, large tournament?
Oh, anything. That was my first any exposure to either to a tournament, to an event. It was my first exposure at all, and it was absolutely mind-bogglingly amazing as my 12-year-old self.
I was blessed with a very good local scene. So we had, you know, frequent RTTs. So I got, you know, a taste of playing with them. And then, I mean, this is a long time before large events were very common. And also way before I had the means to really travel. Like my first travel experience was basically by the grace of some people that had some hotel points that let me crash in their room. The first grand tournament I ever went to was a Games Workshop tournament here in Atlanta. It's the first one they did in Atlanta.
For me, I can't remember if it was, I was in Colorado. It was like 20. I mean, I remember playing an event in Georgia as well. It was part of that Atlanta circuit deal. I don't know if you remember that, Paul. No, I think the first big event I went to was in Colorado. It was Feast of Blades, I think 2012. It was pretty awesome because they had like a narrative and a like competitive event going on at the same time, and so it was a big introduction for me. I was pretty happy with it.
Nice. What is with the name Feast of Blades? Because that's been a name for
play 40K?
Yeah, it's a ritual for the Imperial Fist, actually.
That's what I thought. Yeah, and because it's been taken up by so many different 40K events.
It sounds cool.
Like, has everyone got a Feast of Blades in like their local scene? Because I had one. There's one in New Zealand that's been, it's one of the most long-standing venerable events in New Zealand. It's been running for like, I'm going to say a decade minimum. And everyone's always heard about that being the biggest and best 40K event in New Zealand for years. And I hear, you know, you're saying there's one over there. I think there's one that runs every year in the UK area as well. And so I'm like, has everyone just got a Feast of Blades?
venerable, I think it's Feast one of the, it's one of the first like big lore pieces that a lot of people read, is that it's a tournament.
It's cool.
That the Marines run, if I remember right, back me up. But before we get to Tanya, what was your big first event?
Well, I feel like the odd man out because I had only been playing for a couple months. I dabbled a little bit in seventh, and then I took a really long break when I was playing roller derby, and then I went back into it. And I'd only been playing for like 3 months or so when I went to my first tournament. Was it 3 months? I was in. I was like being mentored by Alex McDougall for 3 months, and then I went to my first tournament, and it was like a 30-person tournament. So it was just barely a GT, I think. And I had a really great time. And then I went to, well, and then like COVID happened like immediately. So there was no real other opportunities for me for almost like a year after that. And then, I went to like an outdoor tournament, which also was about 30 people as well. And then like a really small 12-person RTT. And that's like the extent of my, my tournaments. So I don't really have any like big ones yet. Everything that I was supposed to go to this year is canceled. So,
but next year's your year.
Next year's my year. I am going to LVO because somebody donated a ticket for me. So,
that's awesome.
Yeah. So thank you, Kelsey Ito. You're the man.
Oh, he is the man. That's
He is the man. Yeah, he is.
Well, I mean, what an awesome supporter of the hobby and in this stuff. That's great. And yeah, I'll be there.
I'll be there.
I plan to be there anyway. I'll say that.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just love how everybody comes at it differently. If people are willing, I'm sure Paul wouldn't be against it. Chuck up in the comments what your first event was. Like, where was your first exposure to an event, to a tournament, whatever it may be. I always love hearing where people got started with this game.
Yeah, absolutely. And this past weekend was, I mean, Austin's a great city. I love hanging out there. It's, of course, not the first time I've been there. I've been there for other Warhammer tournaments in the past and some work stuff in the past. And I love the feel and the vibe of the city. It's not Atlanta by any stretch of the imagination, but
tell me about tacos.
So right next to the hotel, there was a street. Now, I guess it's like it's got a bunch of restaurants and bars, and it's there near some other hotels. And every other place in between bars or the hotel or the restaurants or whatever is a taco truck.
Oh,
basically,
baby.
Just has a truck that says tacos on the side of it, and you just roll in, get a taco. You could taco hop if you wanted.
I'm into it.
Yeah.
So you guys have like we call them pub crawls here. You guys have more bars than pubs, right?
Yeah, we're basically bar, but we call them pub crawls. But it's
I'm past my use by date on the pub crawl thing, but I will taco. Skip. I don't know. I will taco skip with the best of them. Let's do this.
We will do it. Next time we get the opportunity, I'll make sure to stay on the lookout, and we will absolutely do it. And then, of course, you know, hanging out. This is the camaraderie from people that you meet, and then hanging out in the hotel area or your areas around there. It's just second to none at these types of things. And so I highly encourage people to come out and do it if you can. You know, if it's the right thing to do, if it's safe for you to do. Get out and do it, because yeah, I just had a blast. Even there, just being there talking about it. I don't know if you can tell, hopefully my voice is recovered enough to where this podcast is listenable. But
I think you sound great.
Thank you. We just had a blast over the course of the weekend, and getting to see some great games. And you know what? Hey, you know, Jakari are still pretty good.
Turns out.
But Tyranids did so well.
Well, I mean, you spam, you know, what is it, three squads of Hive Guard?
That was in a list or two. There was also a list that just had the one squad, two squads. They're a great unit, but they helped support, you know, that whole faction, which was just neat to see that faction that has been categorically kind of absent from the top ranks, the top podiums, get some representation, you know, I mean, through the support of some, you know, several rules releases, but it was still possible. That means fans of that faction, you know, if they cared about that kind of thing, a reason to get out.
Yeah.
Well, I think
it's been there.
Sorry. It's a very good time. We know that there's a Gene Steel Cult Codex coming out in January now. It's been pushed back, unfortunately, but it's still coming. And so if you just had a Leviathan supplement, you know, you could going to have a, you know, a chapter approved, rebalancing of some points, then straight into a new codex. Like, it is a great time for the Hive Mind and should be a phenomenal 2 or 3 months to come.
Yeah, I think so. Got some mini legs under them.
So, you know, having seen all this go through, do you think that it was Octarius that really pushed him over the edge, pushed the Tyranids in?
Oh, I do. Yeah. With the swarm leader, swarm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's swarm leader. I agree. I think that Octarius, you know, when we went through it for Astra Militarum and Tyranid with what it dropped, it just, it didn't seem like it was a lot, but it really is the way that GW has gone about it. It's just enough of a nudge to give the mechanics enough to really, as you said, you know, bring the army into a competitive realm. I think that it's pretty awesome to be able to see what just one book can do with not even a new codex necessarily.
And exactly right. And doubling down on that, they got essentially the path cleared away for their rise as well. So two of the armies that would have given them grief, 100% would have given them grief, being Admech and Drakari, both got significant changes in the way that they have to go about playing the game. Admech has had a fundamental change and it's going to get so people are going to have to go back to the drawing board there. But Drakari got a kind of a forced pivot. The old Drakari book, the previous archetype, the previous best build, would have had no problem tapping Hive Guard from relative safety, you know, turn two, turn three, etc., etc., and had so much stuff in it that things like Devil Gaunts could only, you know, get so many options turn on certain turns and things like that. Whereas now they've essentially had a little bit of the path cleared away for their rise. The other one being Orcs. I felt like Orcs was a bit of a weird one into the Hive Guard. I mean, if they go first, they just fly past the whatever terrain you've got hiding your Hive Guard and they just get hit by, you know, Dakajets and Waz Bombs and all those things. So they also got a few other pieces cleared away from them to make their life a lot easier. So I feel like quality and life improvements from the Leviathan Codex in addition to a bit of gas put in the tank. And then, yeah, some of the stuff that was really going to hold them back, just getting nudged out of the way a little bit. So it's really good times.
A consistent thing we saw, at least that I think you can see on the stream as well, is that the Drakari had to wait until turn two to get really into action, which is not something I had to worry about before. I mean, right now, you know, what they wanted to do was get that power from pain ticked up as well. And the new build seemed to do a lot better once that happened. I see new build, the pivot you were talking about for where things went from largely witches and a bunch of succubuses and fast moving things, you know, things moving 20 plus inches to the Talos and Kronos heavy build, which is incredibly forgiving and durable and hits pretty hard, but not super fast and needed to turn two. So if you found a way to deal with them, not many armies did, in turn one, or at least weaken them in turn one, you know, I think you did a lot better. And I think that's not necessarily bad. You know what you're up against and you know what you can build for.
Yeah, I suppose it's a thing that you get a top meta list or a top competitive list and ask certain questions of your opponent. I feel like the questions that Dark Eldar ask have really changed, like fundamentally changed. I feel like the Admech are still going to ask the same questions of their opponent, like, can you survive XYZ shooting profiles and buckets of them is what I expect to be seeing back from them in a couple of weeks, couple of months. But the Drakari questions is like, do you have a durable profile? Like, are you durable against me? Because you know what you expect? I am durable against you. I'm going to be here for turns and turns and turns. Red, is that a... So, This is Adam's good old segue right into talking about real life military stuff. Is there any kind of that question asking stuff? I mean, there'd be a lot of logistical things similar to that, but is there any parallels between those kind of your opponent asking questions of you and kind of real life military operations?
I mean, yeah, and understanding that we're talking, you know, figuratively in regards
to exactly right.
Not a pun.
But before I jump into that, I gotta start off with saying, One of my Army esports team guys, Ivan Cho, was actually there and went. I think he took 10th. Yeah, he ran the list with 9 Talos and 9 Kronos, and he said it was just ridiculous and its staying power and everything. But yeah, so to your question, in regards of that, you know, it's absolutely. We do a whole process of how you go into tactics and operation. And so when you look at tactics, the first place you always start is intelligence, right? You always start, you're developing the battlefield. You do this intelligence preparation of the battlefield. We call it IPB. And in a lot of ways, even down to the lowest level of tactics, you go about this because you really got to understand where you're at. You got to understand where the enemy's at. You got to understand what they can do within the environment that you have available to you, right? And so when you take something like 40K and it's absolutely applicable because you know the terrain you have, right? You know the way it's laid out, and you just have to be able to understand what you're, if you what your opponent can do. If you don't know what your opponent can do, how can you appropriately go? You don't even know the ability to ask the right questions, right? And so in a real world scenario, it's not, it's clearly, you know, you're not fighting 17, 18 different factions. We've all more or less, you know, you have a pretty good idea of what you're up against in certain regards. However, their understanding of the terrain might be better than yours, or their ability to manipulate it, or they might be able to access something in the battle that, and so are they going to do that? Are they going to take advantage of that? And so in a lot of cases, we come down to what we call, in some cases, we used to call the most likely and most dangerous course of action, right? And so when you make a plan, you would, yeah, well, you would, wouldn't it make sense in some cases for the most likely to be the most dangerous? Why would the enemy not necessarily in some cases choose to be? So there's been kind of a going away from that, which is fine. And so that's the thing is, though, is when you have multiple courses of action, it needs to be discrete enough. It needs to be distinct enough that there's a reason why you have two. Sometimes it's just a branch plan or a sequel, or, okay, if this, then this and this kind of deal. And so to your point, Adam, you know, do we ask those same kind of questions? We absolutely do. And I think that it totally carries over into the wargaming scenarios, in that if you understand what your opponent's able to, and you can ask those kinds of questions, you can come to those kinds of conclusions. And I think with some of the higher levels of play and some of the folks that have been playing for a while, they do that very similar process. They might not break it down in the exact same way, but you'll see, and you know what the problem, especially as we've gone through with new updates and additions and everything, is that some people's question forming process is still based back in 8th edition or 7th edition or even further, right? And so then they get caught off guard when you step into 9th edition or a different mission format or something like that. And so it's a very important process. I would say it's crucial, because if you frame that those questions incorrectly going into it, you will absolutely throw yourself for a loop before you'll let your opponent do it.
Really well said. Yeah, thank you. That answered that wonderfully. Because you never quite know. Is this, you know, it's war gaming, but it might not be war reality, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of aspects to it, but the processes are definitely there. The problem solving and working through it definitely has some application.
I like that. I think you break down a situation, exactly what are the capabilities of the army? What problem are you actually trying to solve? And if you're in how you match up against the enemy. So for instance, if you're trying to get to, if you think your problem is how to get to this objective and score this point instead of how to avoid a 20-inch charge.
Right.
You know, maybe that's a different situation. Mm-hmm. I don't mean 20-inch total. I mean movement, you know, a threat range.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, it's something that I think Tanya's been struggling with a little bit playing guard at the moment. Like, did guard just only ask like one or two questions and don't have enough answers the other way around? Would that be safe to say, Tanya?
Yeah, there's very few answers to the question of even just how do I score the primary? I mean, guard has the potential to put a lot of obsec bodies on the table. It's not a way that I want to play the game. So, but that is a possible answer. But beyond that, I mean, you put like one forest onto the table, and it just neuters guard right now. So I'm really feeling
is punishing. Yeah.
So, and I consider myself a developing player. You know, I'm just learning how to play the game. I've only been in it for like a couple years, and then, you know, COVID has been fun trying to get games in. But so I'm at this point where I'm not able to see how much I've actually learned, because I feel like I don't have the tools to even play the primary mission. So I'm gonna be switching to a couple of new factions for a little bit to try different things.
Yeah, as sad as I am to see another guard player possibly jumping ship, I cannot besmirch you anything, because I didn't exactly the same thing. So yeah, it's just a rough time to be playing a one-dimensional game in a game that demands, you know, three or four dimensions of play, three or four phases of like good, solid, well-roundedness. Mm-hmm. So yeah, is what it is.
And like a lot of people do play underpowered factions, and they do really well with them. However, I find that a lot of people who are doing well with them are people who've played for a really long time, and I haven't done that. Like like I keep a spreadsheet, and I'm at about, like, over the year, I'm at about a 45% win rate, which with Guard is is pretty good.
Well, yeah, it's probably actually respectable.
But as soon as you go into, like, more competitive games, you just, like, quickly realize that you just don't have the tools, really. So yeah, I think for me, where I am in my development, I think just playing something that has a little bit more staying power, I think, is going to allow me to be able to more accurately judge where I am in the learning process.
Well, I mean, the armies that are doing the best right now are the ones that have fast moving and then some amount of reliability, either through rerolls or just through rerolls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm probably going to switch back to Space Wolves for just a little bit, because the Custodes Codex is pushed back, and that's my plan for next year, at least, is to just, like, go hard into Custodes. So.
Sick.
Yeah, I kind of went ham and bought a lot of stuff for Custodes, so I'm committed now. As soon as that book comes in, yeah, I'm gonna be making a list and playing a lot.
That Blade Master, or whatever it is, looks amazing.
I know. I think I'm actually gonna have two of those coming in. Mm. When somebody asks, "Do you want free models?" You're not like, "No," right? You say yes.
I think you are a hobbyist.
So okay, we saw Tyranids do really well this past weekend. We of course saw the Drakkar do really well this weekend. You know, are there some old favorites that can get in there and match up well against those armies? What we didn't see at the top, which I actually thought that we might see more of, was Grey Knights made it really deep, but they didn't take the top four spots. Adeptus Mechanicus didn't take any of the top four spots.
I mean, when you take the planes away and you add about 200, almost 300 points onto the older list, it's I'm not saying that they're totally out of the running by any means, but it was I think folks were a little like they just moved off it. You know, clearly you see folks bringing new stuff, different stuff now.
So it was clear for a while that the Games Workshop terrain system that they use was a little unforgiving for straight up and down gun lines, which for a while, upon release of AdMech, was the best AdMech build. It was the big bricks of Rangers and Vanguard supported by Ballistari. And then when the terrain got even heavier, they pivoted the Ballistari and some of the bricks into things like the planes. You'd have two bombers, two Strataraptors, whatever configuration you'd get. And then we saw innovators like Richard Siegler, who's just been winning all these GW events. Just he's won them all.
That's actually 100% true.
It's actually 100% true. He's won all of them. It's crazy. Yeah. He pivoted into a fully aggressive mobility-based build using Metallica and a lot of Sakaaran units. The Sakaaran build took a lot of hits points-wise in addition to the planes. So that means that you have to almost force to pivot back to what we conceptualize as being AdMech's kind of modus operandi. They're like a high-volume quality shooting list from a decent range as well. Almost like a better Necron build. Who would have thought? But we're seeing less of that, them be able to do the best of everything, because they used to have the equal best or arguably best flyers, the best long range fire support in things like Ballistari and Rangers, and then the best close combat fire in Vanguard, and the best close combat in general, like on par with things like Incubi Witches in, you know, Rustalkers and Infiltrators. So they can't do it all anymore. Because they can't do it all, they're probably going to revert back to what brings them to the dance, the good quality shooting. But that isn't a great archetype on the GW terrain system. Mm-hmm. Because GW's being like, well, we don't want people to auto lose if they go second, turn one, which is what AdMech is asked you.
A couple of the terrain layouts are fairly open in the middle, and it can be brutal. So there, it doesn't shut the door on them, but it does, I think, help, circumvent, I don't necessarily prevent, but five blowouts.
Yeah, exactly right. You're absolutely right. It doesn't prevent them by any stretch of the imagination, because of course then you got player skill comes into it and the nuances of the matchups. But yeah, it certainly makes that build in particular, that list, not the best, best option. Yeah. So I think that just means that AdMech players decided to, maybe play around with their faction a little bit more before figuring out what the next best way forward is. Because they're still a very deep book, a very strong faction. Like, it's anybody who's throwing the baby out with the bathwater, stay with it a bit longer, do things that Paul says, crack open your book, you know, listen to a podcast in the shower, you know, keep your codex next to the dunny, you know, you'll do a lot of learning. You'll figure out a bunch of new exciting builds.
That's fine. You're not wrong, though, but Grey Knights, though, I mean, seriously, I did expect them to be in one of the top four spots, and that might have just been luck of the draw. It might have been just the way they stacked up, you know, which opponent they had and which missions that locked them out. But that build is still every bit as aggressive and mobile.
Absolutely right. So there's a couple of things that have just like little pivots that might be going against them now. The new Drakari build is actually it's not great. It's not a great matchup for them because most of their army is toughness 5 or better, e.g. Stormbolt. The Stormbolter profile isn't great. You deal mortal wounds. They're, you know, most of the Coven stuff has a 5 up against your mortal wounds. You have buckets of damage 2 in combat, which then gets neutered going down to damage 1, and most likely wounds on 5s, you know, hopefully what 4s with a reroll or 5s with a reroll from Hammer Hand.
You got Gatling Psi Cannons, you got...
Well, the thing is, you've got the mobility. You've got the dynamics. The Grey Knight players have the dynamics, the ability to, you know, target bits and pieces, and like you said, you can nuke, you know, one unit a turn pretty well. Like between shooting psychic and combat, you can nuke one unit of Talos Cronus. I don't care what you are. Grey Knights can get the job done. The thing is, though, they can't be everywhere all the time. And the thing is, that's the same question as the Dark Elder. They can't be everywhere. And they're even less ability to be everywhere all the time. And so that's what I think Grey Knight players are going to start to do. They're going to start to just be like, well, I'm going to sit here and get my nice 15 on my sweet little secondary that you can't interact with because you're not a... You know, you're not a psychic army, and then I'm just going to dance around and score the primary and nibble, 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 nuke.
That's the psychic ritual or something, right?
Yeah, purifying ritual.
Yep,
it's so good. It's so good.
It is.
Secondary choices continue to confound folks. I mean, we should actually probably do a whole show on picking secondaries.
We should. Maybe that's next week's show.
Could be, but it was, you know, people would default certain things like, oh, I guess I'll just take Retrieve Octarius data, you know, or, you know, they take things that I think was difficult for them to do because they weren't necessarily sure what to take against some of these, you know, quote, I'm going to use air quotes, new builds for some of these factions. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's one of the biggest, most nuanced things you can do in 40K is having a plan for every matchup secondary wise. Yeah. It's hard to do. Like, it's not something I can say I'm perfect at by any means.
Oh no! In fact, I saw Herd the Prey consistently not working for people.
That's good. That's encouraging, actually, because Herd the Prey was just so many auto points in the bank at times. It was a bit too much. But yeah, even top players. I mean, you cast them all the time, Paul, and I have in the past as well. So many times you'll see a top player taking a subpar third pick on their secondaries, and you just know they didn't have a plan. And it's like, ooh, that might be the thing. Because if the other guy has a plan and you don't, that could just be the whole game right there.
Yep. Yeah, when they're already on turn 2 and they've got about 10 points in the bank, you know, from secondaries, you're like, ugh.
Yeah, yikes.
Something's gone wrong.
One of the other armies that I have been really impressed by is Knights. Just Imperium or Renegade, doesn't matter. People are starting to talk about being scared of Knights again, which is what I want. I don't want Knights to be the best army in the game because I feel like that kind of makes for a bit of an ugly style of meta, of environment. But I want Knights to be something everybody has to think about when they're writing their list. You know? They have to be good enough to be considered.
But let me challenge that just a bit. I don't think that the ninth edition would be a bad area for Knights to be good.
Yeah, because you feel like the terrain is always going to be something that keeps them from...
I feel like the terrain and then the access to weapons that can actually interact with Knights, the fact that all weapons can interact with Knights.
That's fair.
And, you know, the fact that... we did see there was a pretty brutal 13 Armiger / War Dog list there. And then there was like a 9 little baby knight, small knight list that was doing pretty well. And
cool.
Yeah, it was neat to see. And they were really well painted too, which is also cool to see. But I think that the level of interaction on a model-to-model basis in 9th edition is superior to what it has been in previous editions. And so I think Knights, you know, are manageable, even if they were on, some degree, 30% of the tables.
What do you guys think?
I think they're great. I think that it's, and by great, I agree with Paul in regards that I think that they're great for the edition. I think that I don't think that they're so overpowered that they're just going to roll the meta by any means. I think that Eradicators and Dark Lances and those kind of weapons are going to keep them off for the most part. And by off, I mean, there is a balancing act that, and I'm okay with people bringing that. I think that people are already inclined to that to a certain degree with the orc buggies, because you need strength 8 weapons to overcome ramshackle. And so I think the knights are a great bullying aspect of the game that, like, hey, there's these things that, as far as I'm concerned, operate very much like tanks that just roll through the, terrain and whatever else and can just dominate where they are present. There is an answer to them, but if you don't bring that answer, as we go back to the questions metaphor, if you don't bring that answer, you're going to have a really rough time. And I know that's unfortunate because I can think of some armies out there that may struggle to certain degrees in having, especially when you consider like the Armiger or Helverin spam lists for knights and everything. I don't think Tau are as well equipped right now to handle that. I know that they do have a couple relic guns that can lay out some damage, but I just think that it's probably a bit of a struggle for them. I know, for example, Necrons don't really have the best answers for them either.
Totally. Yeah, that's a good call on Necrons as well. I mean, outside combat and, relying on very swingy Doomsday arcs and things, it gets a bit rough.
I don't mind them. I mean, it was nice to see, and I don't know that they. Yeah. I mean, they didn't win the event, but they did well, of course.
They're big, stompy robots. I want them to make impact. I want them to be respected. Right. And you're right. I think that knights would be a hard thing to make OP, but they're one of those things that you could easily see them being oppressive, but not the best, like you said, because there are just lists that will just circumnavigate what they can do. Like, you've got such abilities in this game to turn off OBSEC, and as soon as one knight that doesn't have OBSEC and you've got one guardsman sitting on an objective, it's a moot point that they have OBSEC now. And all that would take would be, denying turning a 5 into a 15 one way or another, and there you go, the game's back on your terms. But yeah, I do love that knights are a thing in the game again, because they were just, like, I think we said it last week or the week before, you'd go into a knights game, you'd get absolutely raffle stomped and walk out with 100 points left of an army and have beaten the knights by 40, 50 points. It didn't translate. Well,
when knights first hit the scene, they were format warping. And I think that you had to almost, change the mission rules to make it to where, again, there was a lot of adjustment that the game had to make to allow for knights to be cool. And I think we finally gotten there.
Yeah, I think they're pretty close to being where they always should have been. I mean, I agree. Like, in I remember the what was the five that was the Royal Court, the five knights in a single slot that you could do in 7th edition?
Was it five or three? That was three.
There was three, and then you could step it up to 5. You got an extra bonus if you went all the way to 5.
And I remember that being like, oh my God.
That was good.
Yeah, it was really good, because they, even if you had good profiles against him, I had invisibility and I got invisibility, I got endurance, I don't care about your knights. And then they just get their D3 stomps and they roll a couple of sixes and like, oh, well, there's some foot-sized bits of my army that aren't there anymore. they just had such X factor around them. You always had to give them some respect.
Well, I guess really what we can say about this list, or the list at that tournament, is that it was pretty diverse, and maybe not towards as we filtered up towards the top, but that was after 8 rounds of a 200 plus person tournament.
And some themes definitely showed up. Like, there's the, it's almost interesting to see the bits of the old Drukhari build that have been somewhat adopted by the Tyranids, the new Tyranid build, because it's not just all Hiveguard, by the way. People might be thinking, oh, it's just Hiveguard, because of what one gentleman did taking 17 of the things. Gene Stealers are still a big factor, e.g., Drakari-esque things like Hellions, very comparable to Hellions, witches, and Incubi. In addition to kind of a newcomer on the scene, which is a bit of a throwback to some of the things we saw in 8th edition, the Devil Gaunt's making a big impact. What do you guys make of this?
Devil Gaunt. I was going to say, the Swarm Lord is not a newcomer on the scene.
He's not. he's old enough to own. He has on his trophy cabinet. He's got 2 of Marnius Kalgar's arms.
Oh, today! Listen, I know this is sidetrack, and I don't want to do it, but I'm very proud of myself. I don't know if y'all remember. This is an old throwback to I have a spare Marnius Kalgar head. Yeah, I put it on a Death Guard Terminator today.
Oh, amazing! Amazing.
It was Lord Felthus or whatever. I didn't really care for his face in that set of Blight Lord Terminators, and so I replaced that head with Marnie's Caligar set.
Oh man, that's so good.
So sorry, I went on.
You should paint it pristine.
Yes.
Yeah, maybe I will. Maybe I will.
Two Power Fists.
But Devil Gaunts, talking about a comeback. What are you, those for the exploding sixes?
Yeah, the exploding sixes. And now with options of plus one to hit, full rerolls to hit. They become very, very, very deadly. And of course, with Swarm Lord and you know things like Metabolic Overdrive, rather, you have a lot of agency in where you position them. Like you can have them deployed very safely and then moving out to get into better positions very quickly. I think they're a good unit, and they're kind of to my mind, I am more scared of them than I am of the Hive Guard. If that makes sense to anybody.
That does not make any sense.
Because I know in my heart, I know how much hurt is going to come from the Hive Guard every turn.
Oh, so you're already resigned to it.
I'm resigned to copying it, you know? Like, yeah, this is dead.
And you don't mind, because everyone knows about Hive Guard. You don't like, I guess I lost some miles to Hive Guard, but no one wants to go back and tell the story where I just lost this whole unit to Devil Gaunts.
Exactly right. No one wants to be. Because I hear stories about people just like losing redemptive dreadnoughts to Devil Gaunts, and you're like, huh? Like, my heart is not ready to accept that loss, you know?
That will not be in the litanies of the chapter.
No. Some feisty cockroaches tore out my heart today.
So they're targets for stratagems and for abilities of the other powerful creature, just Swarm Lord.
Well, do you remember the last time we saw something that did the same thing as them?
Oh, no.
Anybody throw one out? I think Red will know, if you know.
The last time we saw what, sorry?
Something similar to what the Devil Gaunts are doing in the Tyranid Codex, or the Tyranid builds now.
Dark Reapers?
No, but close. Think crappy fire.
Oh.
With just a bucket of buffs.
Hmm.
8th edition Chaos Cultists.
Oh, yeah. I was about to say, like, my are you talking about my Astra Militarum infantry squads right now? Or
no, I wish.
So you're talking about buffing cultists with the Veterans of the Long War. And
that's true, yeah.
Double back shooting them, still. Prescience on them, rerolls of, you know, they could get rerolls to hit back then. I think it was only reroll ones. And you could just do so much stuff with them. They would just explode exponentially in what they were able to accomplish. You're like, this, I do not need to be afraid of this auto gun. They're like, oh my God, I lost half my army to auto guns this turn. You know, that kind of feeling. And so it's interesting.
Yeah, I like it. Again, the fact that this codex, I know it's we heard Mr. Hickton come on and talk just about it, just basically gush about the faction. We know he's played the faction for a long time. And then seeing players really get to play that faction, I can't be anything but proud for him.
Yeah, I'm always happy to see a faction that's been down in the dumps just get a bit of time in the sun, bit of chance to feel like they've got some agency and they can have a game into anybody.
So keep it up. All right, let's take a break and then we'll come back. We'll talk a little bit about lore. So we're going to have a spoiler-free lore discussion about the Siege Terror.
I appreciate that.
See you on a
minute. I'll do my best.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Hey everybody, we are back. So I got the whole crew here. So this segment is spawned from the fact that Adam before the show was talking about maybe dipping into playing White Scars because he thought they would do pretty well in the meta. And we're also talking about how Blood Angels actually really play decently well into the Jakari build, at least in theory, I think, with and not with Sanguinary Guard because they're damaged to weapons. But everything else, if you especially get some of those damaged one stuff on the cheap or a volume of it with Death Company, play really well into the big Kronos and Talos pivot that Jakari have done.
And the only reason I'm not sure that that Sanguard are going to do it is just because I feel like the Sanguard units people are taking these days are usually on the smaller side, like the 4, 5, 6 side, where what you really need is to have just a big dump of high AP. Doesn't matter about the damage. You're just looking for quantity over quality.
I'm still taking Sanguinary Guard. I just might take two units and then one unit of Death Company to go up there and handle like a bigger unit of Death Company, not just three or four man Death Company.
Well, so there's some issues with the matchup. So you've got stuff like Kronos, which are very hard to charge because their flamers on Overwatch are hellaciously horrible. If you've got small Sanguard units, you're like, well, I'm not going to let my 10-man Vanguard vet unit just instantly all die to this. So 4-man Sanguard, sacrifice yourselves. Thank you very much. Overwatch, not a problem. And then num, 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 eat them. But yeah, I've been getting pretty deep into the Siege of Terra books. I finished, I finished Solar War, I finished Lost in the Damned, and now almost finished the first Wall. And it's been a hell of a ride so far, guys. Where's everyone else up to?
I'm about halfway through, actually about 3/4 of the way through Warhawk.
I hear very good things.
It's good.
So I've been doing audiobooks recently with my drive and everything built into work. And so I actually have not, I kind of taken a break from the Horus Heresy and have just finished all of the like Eisenhorn, Ravenor, and Beckwin books.
Again, is that a reread?
So it was of Eisenhorn and some of the Ravenor material. And so it was good to like finish all that. And then I had never read the Beckwin books before. And, that was pretty awesome material. I got to say that pretty mind blowing stuff.
I've not read those either. I plan to read them.
They're great. They are fantastic. There's some stuff to it, especially where you're at right now and everything. Like there's some great appreciation for what Dan Abnett does, of course. And so to all that to say, I'm actually listening to, I've already read it before, but I'm listening to it because I wanted to, the, Talarn book. Mm-hmm. From the Horus Heresy. I'm listening to it's like a collection of all the little Talarn short stories, which is really great. And then my next one on my list is the Buried Dagger, and then I will start Siege of Terra.
Buried Dagger's good.
And I'm looking forward to it. I've got it, I have to do the audiobook.
So it's less excited about Death Guard than you might think, but it's the stuff that isn't about Death Guard is also just as awesome.
Sure. Yeah, no, yeah. I'm really, really looking forward to it.
So I have, and this is Paul's not gonna like this bit, this next sentence. I have some issues with how Sanguinius has been written.
Oh, that was actually where I stopped him when he mentioned that. I'm like, nope, we probably need to talk about this if we can do it without spoilers.
Yes. Well, so this is from more than just the Siege of Terra, but naturally, having finished Lost in the Damned, it's very Blood Angel centric in a lot of ways, and you get a lot of things from Sanguinius' perspective. The depth of his melancholy annoys me. I find him annoying to read.
Man, do you not understand that the Siege of Terra is a very serious thing?
I do, but see, I think
serious,
so,
man. Right,
I know. Well, it started for me in one of my favorite books, Unremembered Empire, and the trilogy there. That's where it started for me, my exposure to reading Sanguinius' story and the perspectives and his flawedness as a character, which I find incredibly amazing, and I feel like they could do more with it. Because rather than it being, that melancholy has become the defining part of him. Rather than that being, I'm a determination for Sanguinius to make his life matter, in my perspective, and this is the way I'm interpreting it, Rob, by the way, people can read this in so many different ways. I feel like the writing has been too centralized on every single one of his sentences has to end with him knowing that what is going to happen to him, because of course he has the gift of foresight and he sees his kind of end approaching. I feel like it's been too much centered around that, and rather been centered around the drive he has to make a difference before this inevitable end. This drive, and because you can see that in his actions, that what he's determined to do, he's putting himself in harm's way at the siege again and again. Again, amazing, amazing scenes that they've written for him, but yet it's all kind of had the legs cut off for it with this just really kind of sadness. This is in
super
my estimation.
Tough crowd here. Super. Tough.
I know. I'm sorry. I'm really sorry, but yeah, this is just the way I've read it and I've interpreted it. Like,
it's like a build up. I mean, there's no spoilers here because everybody knows man's going to bite it. You know what I mean?
Exactly right.
It's all coming. It's but like down. At the same time, like, I mean, Conrad Curse, like if you read the Aaron Dembski Bowden books, Soul Hunter and everything, like for the Night Lords, like Conrad doesn't really take it well either, you know, like, I mean, quite clearly. And I think he pretty much knew how everything was going to go way back when. And so, like, you know, give a man a break. Give a demigod Primarch angel a break, man. He's about to get wrecked.
Well, the things that I notice in the book, slightly different take than Mr. Camilleri here, is that he is in his moments of reflection, you know, personal reflection, weighed down by the fact that he knows what his end's going to be. He already knows that. He knows that. But to your point, his actions are inspiring to others, and the authors typically let you know that they know that. And so others will react to what Sanguinius has done.
Yeah, I suppose my annoyance comes from the bit that he was so almost morose and unremembered empire when he had to take up the mantle of, you know, possible, I don't want to spoil it too far, but Imperium Secundus and the role he had to take there, or felt like he had to assume, and felt like he was already tinged with this, you know, like I said, moroseness around his own end. He's had a long time to come to terms with the gents. He's had a fair lot of time, I guess.
That makes it all the easier.
That's right. No, I just mean it's
you really are a dark angel.
I guess it's tiresome. It's right, grim resolve, eh? Yeah, I'm pretty I'm tired of that being the only narrative of the character, the only defining part of him, something, because I believe he should be greater than that one moment, and that he should be looking and written in such a way to make him greater than the sum of his end, so to speak, when it seems like everything is only about his end. Even him doing incredible things and self-sacrifices and putting himself in harm's way is all because of he knows this isn't how his end is supposed to end.
Okay. I'm going to be a little bit controversial here, but maybe just because I haven't read a lot of the Horus Heresy and like Primarch sort of centered stuff. What book should I read if I want to see a Primarch as something other than one dimensional? Because so far, they're all pretty one dimensional.
Oh, Tanya coming in with the spice.
Savage. Well, I think the two best ones for that is Magnus. I find it's very non-one-dimensional, or at least they go out of their way to make him seem very philosophical and deep in a lot of ways.
But like, and he's almost one-dimensional in that. What else does he have?
Most of the Primarchs want to do other things. Like, Pritchard-Robber wants to be an architect.
So, well, to Magnus, Magnus wants to be a scholar. He's stuck in the duality of his purpose, as in what he was built to be, e.g. this super powerful, potent mind. And then the shackled restrictions placed upon him by his father are kind of riling against it. It's kind of sometimes it's petulance, sometimes it's like adolescent, almost in the way he goes about it. But at the same time, it's tinged by this fact that he just has this potential inside him that I feel like we can all relate to. And in some ways of being felt like we're being held back or held down or persecuted. So yeah, I feel like there's more. Magnus is a good example of someone who you can dive into the character. But you're right, there are some that you can't. Like, I don't know anything about Korax apart from like Nevermore and yeah.
I think Tanya, to that, I think Betrayer did a good and interesting job of showing Lorgar.
It's good. Yeah, great one.
I think that
not just Lorgar.
I mean Angron to an extent too. But I don't feel like Angron does a great job escaping the issue that Tanya's pointing out here and being one-dimensional. But I think Lorgar shows you get into his thought process and you get to see where he's going with some of the things. But I agree. If you're talking about that, I think that the other Space Marines, you really get to see some better reflections in that too.
Yeah, that's where all the character comes out, is in the other Space Marines.
Exactly. Guys like Loken, guys like Abaddon to some extent for some things, and like Ahriman might be my best example, the way he's been written, the way he's been done. He's just one of the best written characters.
I feel like he is like the SpongeBob meme, where he's like, well, guess I'm gonna head out then.
That's great.
For the Horus Heresy, I agree. I admit that he's got some plot armor in the John French books, in my opinion. But if you haven't read those, the Armand trilogy, it's pretty good. I like it shows this wide range of sorcerer powers and covens and all sorts of stuff. It's pretty cool. But I think that the Horus Heresy Armand, like I can see that. I think that the I'm trying to think of some more stuff in regards to the Primarchs.
Well, Dorn, in the Siege of Terror books, like all of them across the board, Dorn gets a pretty big spotlight.
But is it enough of a spotlight to be like, you know, more than one dimensional?
So most of the time he is, as you might expect, just kind of hanging out and making sure our walls get built.
Are summed up the entire character, right?
Yeah.
I call him stoicism personified.
He's but there are several chapters and more than just a passage or two that show him the other aspects of where the Crimson Fist and where the Black Templars come from. It shows. You can see it there, all just kind of specked out. And that part is cool. And I'm not a big Dorne fan. I mean, I like Black Templar, but Dorne as a character, I could just kind of, you know, basically give or take. I mean, there's no Sanguinius, you know what I'm saying? But they give him, I think there's just so many passages in the book that maybe the personalities come out. And I know that the intent is there to also do exactly what I described, just kind of show where the other, you know, well-known successor chapters come from this lineage.
I think Jagatai is a really interesting character as well. And I'm loving that I haven't read Warhawk yet, but I hear you learn a lot more about his mindset and things from there. It's actually, now to think about it, there's a couple that really are one-dimensional. And there are a couple that, like, I feel like they've done a phenomenal job. I found the Kurz novel extremely enlightening.
Like, well, they all are. I mean, I think that's really by design, is that they are. And this is, let me wax philosophical for a second.
Uh-oh.
Is that the Primarchs are essentially all vector locked. They cannot act any other way than what they do. Like, they are by design, from the single cell to what you see before you on the page, to be a single use tool.
Mm. And the facets that they're built to, like, I mean, even in the Kurz novel, he laments that he himself was built to be a butcher, a murderer. Like, he was nothing more than what he was always meant to be. He's talking to, in fact, I think if I remember right, he's talking to Korax, and that you got to be built to be like the assassin, the saboteur, the infiltrator, whatever, and I got to built to be a murderer, you know. And, you know, how is this fair? Lamenting that he's only the sum of his parts rather than being able to be anything greater, which could be why Sanguinius is the way Sanguinius is, you know, to counterpoint myself.
Sheesh.
Well, do you think Sanguinius was built to always know when his death was? And that was to be like the thing that humbled someone who was in all intents and purposes nearly perfect, you know?
Yep. Yep. That's him a little mopey.
Bring him down. Bring him down to our level.
Well, to be also, is it Sanguinius is kind of, I mean, this is going to sound, bear with me, please.
I'm really excited.
He's cursed to almost be too perfect.
Oh, yeah. Man.
And he can't ever lean into it because, you know, it like it would, like the Imperium Secundus. No spoilers for I Don't Remember the Empires. It's one that you could easily, I think, just kind of read the premise and think that maybe you shouldn't read it, but you absolutely should read it because there's so much cool stuff in it.
There is.
But when he shows up, they're like, well, obviously, since you're here, you're the Emperor. And he's like, oh, man, not again. You know, I don't want to be.
My father. On a pedestal. Yeah.
You know, I get it. I got the wings and I wear a lot of gold, you know, and I am pretty good with this sword. You know what I'm saying? That's not good enough, though.
Couldn't close.
My chin is damn.
Savage.
No shots fired all over the place. But he just, you know, that's it. It's part of his makeup to act that way. I think that part is the resistance to that.
Yeah. I mean, I totally agree with where you're going with the Unremembered Empire, the Ruined Storm. There's a couple others that are all centered around that whole scenario. Those are, I think, you know, so that brings me back to Tanya's question. Tanya, I think that you'll see in that series, I believe, you see a really good dynamic, and by good, I mean it's great to observe the dynamic between Gilliman, Sanguinius, the Lion, and Kurz.
Exactly right. It's done so well. Like, whoa.
Yeah,
it's
my favorite. Really well with that.
It is my favorite book in all the Siege Terror or Horus Heresy. Okay. Yeah, yeah. Well, because I'm a big Lion boy, and man, is he a jerk? Like,
man, he's so cool in that one.
He's almost like flips, and there's a lot of other cases where you've seen him and he's been very, very reserved. And without ruining it, like not saying that he isn't reserved in that as well. Like he holds up to his name, but there's just so many other dynamics that are brought into it that it's absolutely worth the read. I would not.
Kurz does all kind of stuff.
That's gonna hurt. Oh man. And that's,
you know, for a fact, Dan Abnett does not know his stats.
Well, that goes back to Dan Abnett's ability, like how he writes. I mean, if you read any of the Gaunt's Ghost or Eisenhorde series, and Space Marines are like always turned up to like 14 in those books. And so he carried it over, but it was like, well, everyone else gets to be normal, but Kurse gets to be 14. He gets to be turned up.
I love it though, because I mean, I read a lot of comics, and one of the most cool, the coolest things about comics, and by the way, the 40K novels are not the same as comics, but one of the coolest things about comics is that any character can be whatever power level it needs to be to make the story happen, you know, right there.
Yeah.
And this is when, you know, Kurz is, it's not that the story needs him to be a certain way, it's that he's decided to go off the chain and do all this stuff and basically just figure out just how far can he push it.
Yeah.
And I like it.
Yeah, he gets to be undiluted Kurz.
It's pretty good.
Yeah, because so one of the amazing things I
are you done harshing on Sanguinius?
Yeah, I'm done. I'm done with that. I'm now loving on Kurz at the moment, because even so, one of the beautiful things in that novel was Kurz describing the fall of his legion, the corruption that ended up happening. Because prior to there's two different sections of kind of the Night Lord storyline. I'm sure there's many more, but there's two that I've identified. There's the part where they're a legion based on the use of fear and terror in order to, and the modus operandi was to, let's make a couple of very brutal, very dramatic things happen, which will cause us to, you know, from their point of view, the butcherous and horrible things that the murders they would do to, you know, gain compliance during the Great Crusade was perfectly justified, because they'd kill a handful of people, whereas, you know, the Imperial Fist, the Iron Warriors would kill thousands, tens of thousands, millions in order to do the same thing. And they're like, just because we do unscrupulous means, we get the same result with far more intact cities and towns and infrastructure. We do a better job than you, but you just are not prepared to do what it takes to, you know, maximize what we do. And so they were just a legion that had a different perspective, albeit a terrifying one. And then there was the switch into kind of sadism, the absolute brutality of what they did through the corruption of their legion. And it's a really interesting part of the story, of the theme, because there was it shows you a glimpse at the paradigm shift that happens on Nostromo, the homeworld of the Night Lords, and the political maneuvering that occurred in order to corrupt the legion. And e.g. like the blood vessels, the blood that was getting pumped into the heart of the Night Lords started to be poison tainted, and how it translated into things that happened in the Siege of Terror. And then Kurz's perspective that, he lost touch from his legion. He allowed this. Because he was so lost in his mania, in his own issues. You know, you can almost say there's a lot of very, very real mental health parallels you can have with so many of the Primarchs. And that he was so out of it during this time, and that he didn't have a chance to stop it. By the time he came to, he was like, "Wow, my legion has fallen so far, and we are not worth saving." And so then he abandoned his legion. And essentially went off and did what he was doing. But it's really good, guys. It's really good.
I fully admit that I used to pick out my Horus Heresy novels by, I'd look at the Persona Dramine or whatever they called it at the beginning, to see
something along those lines.
Yeah.
And Gwynnis in this, not, is Raldron in this? Not, all right, put it back.
Yep. Well, no, just if it had three or four Primarchs, I'm like, well, I'm going to read this one. Yeah,
that's true. Actually, I've done the same.
Because I wanted to see the Primarchs. But, you know, you get a few novels deep and you're like, whoa, the real heart of these legions and these stories is actually in the legionaries. And
mm-hmm. Yeah, and
they even lament about like, oh, we're just getting thrown about, you know, by the whims of these children squabbling, you know, essentially.
Yeah, dude.
So I came to appreciate those characters.
I haven't really read a lot about the Primarchs. Like I said, like I'm having trouble actually getting books, and I've got a couple that are in the mail somewhere. if people don't know, my sort of area of the world is a little bit cut off right now. So they're somewhere in the mail. And so in terms of Primarchs, the only one that I read was that I really liked was Horus before his fall.
Mm-hmm.
He was just so, like, he was so likable, so charming and charismatic, and you could tell that he just, like, really cared for his men. Yeah. And that's why it was so disappointing that, like, spoiler alert, he fell, but he fell so easily, you know?
Did anybody else, I don't know who was into pro wrestling, because I grew up in, like, the golden age of pro wrestling. Does anyone else just feel like Horus was, like jokingly at some point based on Hulk Hogan, you know, and then he was the charisma magnet, and then he turned to went to the NWO and just kind of fell to chaos.
Except this story predates that by 10 years, probably 10 years.
The fall of Horus, of course, but you know, the writing of
that Hulk Hogan is more charismatic than Macho Man.
Oh, that's true. But I mean, you know, he was the everyman's Primarch, you know.
I guess
we could probably cast all the Primarchs as 80s and 90s wrestlers.
But that has been done, by the way. Shawn Michaels, baby. You know, he's definitely, well, actually, he could be like five, probably Fulgrim though.
He would be my pick for Fulgrim for sure.
Undertaker, you know. options are endless.
We could be here. We could be all night. We're gonna wrap this up. This has been fun.
It's just getting good.
Yeah. We'll have to come back with that. You know, I want to talk about lore sometimes too, but you know, don't want to risk spoiling things for folks. But the novels are good, and they've just gotten better and better. And then, I mean, there's some of the novels that are kind of just like gems, like almost like sleeper gems. I think all the Mechanicus stuff that Graham McNeil did is actually pretty stellar, and it's kind of its own thing as far as the rest of the story goes. But they give you a lot of insight into the Mechanicus and Dark Mechanicus.
The Dark Mechanicus is terrifying.
Yeah. They don't pull any punches in these either. It's pretty neat. And it kind of happens a little bit out of sequence with some of the novels when it came out. So there's a scene. One of the things I love about these novels is that they've taken, you know, the 10 paragraphs that existed about that and just sprinkled the knowledge and expanded upon the knowledge or whatever. And there is a scene where I think it's the Imperial Fist show up to get all the Mark VI armor off of Mars right before Horus gets there. And that's something from the novels. From source material a long time ago.
Mm.
And I'm just like, whoa, they did it. That's so cool. That's it. That's the show for this week. Very sorry for missing last week. Check out some of the coverage on Warhammer TV, twitch.com/Warhammer. Maybe catch... see what I was doing last weekend. And then we'll all be back next week.
Sweet.
Looking forward to it.
Have a great evening, everybody.
See you.
Oh, man, I'm going to cop it in the comments.
Tenets demand you tune in next week for the greater good, of course.